Hi, everyone. So nice to be here again with all of you from so many different places all over the world. It's such a nice connection that we have here at Sangha Live in this pretty challenging time for our world community. It's nice to be able to gather like this and to practice like this. Community is so important at this time. So it's my pleasure to be joining you again today. As Caroline said, today the topic is Two Wings to Fly, Cultivating Both Wisdom and Compassion. And so I'll be teaching you a technique to cultivate compassion today. And as we do the technique together, I'll explain a little bit more about how it also is cultivating wisdom, and how wisdom and compassion complement each other. And so after that, as Caroline said, I'll offer a Dharma talk, talking a little bit more about that, some of the context behind what we're practicing together, and some of the history, and more about how you can apply it in your daily life. So how you can bring this off of the cushion into your life, into your relationships. And then after that, I'll be able to answer some of your questions. All right, well, so to start, I think it might be helpful. I'm just gonna, before you close your eyes and practice, I'll give you a little overview of what we're gonna do, just to give you just one more time of the kind of concept of what we're going to do. So the technique that we're going to do today is adapted from my teacher Shinzen Young's collection of teachings, which he calls Nurturing Positivity. And so we're going to explore together positivity or compassion, goodness, generosity, love and kindness. We're going to explore these themes in three different places or spaces in your experience. And so the first place is going to be in your mind, and in particular in the place where you experience your visual thinking. So the place where you see images, people, places, things. And so I'm going to ask you to bring into that space an image of either you doing a positive action, you know, like helping somebody, helping a neighbor, something like that, or giving somebody a hug. Or you can choose an image that is more symbolic. It could also just be a person who you know. So it could be, you know, you're a relative or a friend, a neighbor who, you know, is just a really good person who you aspire to be like or appreciate. Or it could be a symbolic being, like an archetype. So like behind me on the table is Guan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. So something like that. So you're going to bring to mind an image that to you is positive. And then we'll shift away from that, and I want you to bring into your mind, but in particular the place in your mind where you do your auditory thinking. So this is where you talk to yourself, where you hear memories of other people talking, or sounds. I want you to bring into that place some positive talk that's associated with that image. So it would be, you know, like a word, a phrase. It could also just be like a syllable, something that symbolizes to you goodness, loving kindness. So it could be a word like love, or a phrase like may all beings be happy. And so I'll ask you to do that. And then our third destination on this tour is the body, and in particular the place in the body where you feel emotions or feel positive feelings. And so I'll ask you then to bring attention to your body and create or connect with some positive feeling there. So, and I'll explain some different ways to do that. One, you may just already have positive feeling in your body from being together, you know, taking this time together. You might already feel kind of some pleasantness, or we can evoke some of those feelings in the body through visiting those, the image that you've created or the mental talk that you've created. You can also just put a physical smile on your face and feel how that can kind of pump up good feelings in the body physically. So I'm going to go through those and then bring them all together at the end, kind of stack them on top of each other. So without further ado, let's do it. So find a posture, a position that's comfortable for you. Ideally, you could be, you know, at ease doing this, relaxed, allowing those positive feelings to flow. So go ahead and close your eyes. And set an intention right now to bring an attitude of gentleness to this, friendliness. So you're not efforting too hard here, but also, you know, not being too loose. Just a nice balanced effort. Notice your breathing. Great. Okay, now bring attention to the place where you see mental images. So for most people, this is somewhere in front of or behind their closed eyes. This is the place where you see images of people, places, objects. Now, bring to mind an image of either yourself doing a positive action. I mentioned before, it could be you giving somebody a hug, cooking a meal for a ill neighbor, or choose an image that is of another person or a symbolic being, somebody who's just good in your life, or a archetype, somebody who represents goodness to you. So bring that image to your mind and refresh it as needed. We're just getting started. So you're exercising some concentration muscles here, getting them warmed up. Keep returning to that image each time you get pulled away. You'll notice how your attention may get pulled into other experiences, maybe other images, or You might get pulled into sensations in your body, sounds in the room or outside of the room, some of your own mental talk. Just notice that that's happened. And bring attention back to that image that you're creating. You're creating over and over. See if you can stay connected with it. Anchor into it. Sometimes the opposite of what you're intending can arise. You're trying to focus on a positive image, and it can happen that a negative image will come up. So just notice that those are different, that that's not what you intended. And you don't have to get rid of or push away that other image. Just let it be in the background and turn gently away from it and ground your attention in that positive image that you're creating, that you're generating. In this way, you are exercising excuse me, what my teacher calls sensory clarity. This is the ability to untangle all these different experiences that we have, see them as separate and different. So continue to generate that positive image of yourself or another positive being. And soak your attention into it. Great. Okay. Now let that go. And shift your attention now to the place where you hear your internal talk, your mental talk. For most people, this is located somewhere inside their head, around their ears, in that kind of location. So bring attention there now. And create some positive mental talk. So this could be a word, a phrase, could be just a syllable, something that's positive to you, maybe something related to that image that you've created. Could be something like, may all beings be happy. Or a word like love, compassion, generosity. So repeat this word or phrase or syllable to yourself every so often. Maybe every breath or every few breaths, whatever pace feels right to you. And as you're repeating that phrase to yourself, again, really focus on it. So it's not just something you're repeating, but you're really feeling into it as you say it to yourself. Again, bringing that intention of gentleness, of friendliness. Notice how the attention gets pulled into other experiences, into perhaps other mental talk, into images or sensations in the body. When you notice that this has happened, gently bring attention back to that positive mental talk that you're creating, refreshing it, being patient, continuing to direct your focus on that mental talk. Okay, Great. Now let that go and bring attention to your body. In particular, bring attention to the places in your body where you tend to feel emotions. So for many people, this is through the midline of the body, through your face, your throat, through your chest and abdomen. So just notice right now, perhaps there's some pleasant feeling already there. Might be very subtle. So if there is pleasant feeling there, you can focus on that. Or you may want to try one of these other ways of evoking or creating positive feeling in the body. So one way that you can create or evoke feeling is, well, for some people, it's just kind of easy to reach in and bring up a positive feeling, kind of like drawing water from a well. So that's another way to think about it, is you're just reaching in and allowing a positive feeling to arise, bringing it out of your well. You could also, my teacher Shinzen calls this striking the body bell. So you could strike the body with a thought, such as a mental image, like the one you've created already, and or your mental talk, that word or phrase that you've created. So you can revisit those and see if when you do that, there's an associated pleasant feeling in the body. So it's like you're striking the body with a little striker of one of those thoughts, and the body resonates with that like a bell. And one other way that you can bring positive feeling into the body is just by putting a smile on your face, physically doing the activity of smiling. There's research that shows that this works. So choose one of these methods or try a few and see if you can connect with some positive feeling in the body. Refresh this feeling every so often, grounding your attention in it. It might be very subtle, might be kind of faint to begin with. And just see if you can detect it and focus on it, bringing attention back each time that it gets pulled away. other experiences may be arising for you, other sensations in the body, other feelings in the body. Perhaps you're noticing some negative feelings. Those can be there. You don't need to get rid of them. Just matter-of-factly bring attention back. Turn it to that positive feeling that you're creating, letting that other stuff be in the background. In this way, you're exercising the skill of equanimity, not pushing and pulling on experience, just allowing it to be there and gently turning toward your intended experience here, this positive feeling in the body. Great job. Now, bring back that image that you created at the beginning and that mental talk that you created, that positive word or phrase. So you can think about floating between these three experiences, the image, the mental talk, and the emotions in the body. Or you could think about stacking them on top of each other. So with the freely floating part, you know, you're just kind of alternating between the three experiences, touching into them, each of them, really, really soaking attention into them when you touch into them, allowing them to interact with each other. And pump up or influence each other, you know, so it's like this feedback loop where they're creating more positivity in each other. Or you could think about stacking them. So it's like you're holding that image and at the same time bringing to mind that positive talk and connecting with that positive feeling in your body. So bringing those all together. So you might want to explore one or both of those ways of being good. This is replacing our usual thoughts and feelings with this goodness, this positivity. Continue to connect with that, refreshing each of those areas or spaces, each of those experiences, and allowing them to grow and spread through the body and the mind. Great. Okay. So you can take a few deep breaths now. Allow your eyes to slowly open. And see if you can, even with your eyes open right now, still connect in the body with that sense of positive feeling that you created. Whatever flavor you might name it, maybe it's happiness or joy, love, compassion, humor. So just continuing to feel that with your eyes open. Great. Okay. So I wanted to share with you now in this time that I have left to talk to you a little bit more about kind of the context of what we just did and some of the concepts as well. So kind of how compassion practices fit into the bigger scheme of different practices you can do. And how the wisdom practices and the compassion practices can complement each other, how they work together. So I'm going to start with that. Okay, so my teacher, Shinzen Young, or actually, let me tell you this first. So what we just did, it looks a lot like in Tibetan Buddhism, they have this practice called deity yoga, where you're, you know, imagining this ideal being, this deity, and then you are bringing your own mind and body into that image. So kind of interfacing with that and becoming that. And so in that tradition, in Tibetan tradition, there is this practice that's very much like what we just did. Also, if, you know, many of you are in Europe, actually this is here in the US as well, or any countries that have Christian traditions, there is the Stations of the Cross in churches where they show like these different, I don't remember how many there are, but these different, you know, portrayals of Jesus as he was being crucified. And the practice is that the practitioner will go and contemplate each of these images, you know, and in that way, you are bringing yourself in conversation with that experience, that particular time of experience that Jesus was having throughout that story of the crucifixion. So like that's another practice, another tradition of practice, which is similar, you know, where you're kind of joining with that experience. So I just want to offer those as a kind of world context. And so back to my teacher, Shinzen Young. So he talks about these three skills that we are cultivating in mindfulness practice. And they apply to more insight-oriented practices, concentration practices, and also to these loving kindness practices, which some people would say are actually kind of a kind of concentration practice. So I'm going to show you this little slide I made. So these are the three skills that Shinzen talks about. The first one is concentration power. The second one is sensory clarity. And the third one is equanimity. And so in the practice that we just did, you know, it exercised this muscle of concentration, which is the ability to attend to what you want, when you want. So we did that by, you know, trying to stay connected with that experience, that image or that mental talk, and or that feeling in the body. And, you know, as you get pulled away, you gently bring your attention back. And that is, you know, skill that's used in, I think, pretty much every kind of meditation we can do. So whether it's an insight practice or a compassion practice. Similarly, you were needing to exercise this muscle of sensory clarity by distinguishing the different experiences. You know, you had this intention to focus on the image that you were creating, and then you might have had other images come up, and you could distinguish, this is different than this image. You know, they're arising and passing. So you're getting this insight into impermanence, and also into also exercising the skill of sensory clarity. And lastly, the skill of equanimity is this ability to not push or pull on your experience unnecessarily. So in order to focus on something, we need to bring kind of this matter of fact attitude towards it without stressing too much about this other stuff that's coming up that maybe we're not wanting to focus on. So equanimity is this ability to kind of allow these things to arise and pass naturally. Again, you're seeing the activity of impermanence there as things arise and pass, and not taking any of it to, not stressing out too much about any of it, not pushing or pulling too hard. There is this in the loving kindness practice, you know, you are preferring this particular focus, continuing to turn towards it, but you know, not stressing out too much about this other stuff that's naturally arising. So in that way, you know, these compassion practices are similar to the mindfulness practices or insight practices that we do. One of the other articles, and I'll send you guys some of these links again later, but in one of the email blasts that you got, there were some articles linked to one of my reflections. And I was introducing you, you may already know him, but this teacher, and I think he's also a psychologist, Rick Hansen, he has this great way of putting wisdom and compassion as these terms. He uses the terms be with versus work with, or you could say and work with. So be with and work with. And so the, you know, some of these insight-oriented practices are just allowing experience to unfold. You're just witnessing it. You're being with. And these compassion practices are more of a work with. But you might see that there are elements of both being with and working with in each of those practices. So I'll share with you, I'll just share this with you as an example. So when I was first practicing with Shinzen and starting to do retreats with him, I was doing, you know, more of traditional insight-oriented practices, and had this experience, you know, of the sense of self starting to break down. So that sense of like it being so solid, and, you know, some of the drivenness and some of the, you know, craving, and just, you know, a lot of that, you know, push and pull energy was starting to just like fall away. And very naturally, what arose out of that place was this insight that, you know, there really was nothing else to do but serve other people. So it was like, you know, just this natural goodness was kind of uncovered when that craving and all that drivenness And that sense of kind of the suffering self, when that was released, it was like, there's nothing else to be done in this life other than to do good. And, you know, that wasn't some sort of like psychological insight or some striving of to be a better person. It was like just this stuff had fallen away and that was what was left. So in that way, these things, you know, this insight and this compassion, this wisdom and this compassion, they are very much, you know, related, like they're interrelated. They uncover each other in a way. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about other ways to practice. And, you know, talked a little bit about what we just did. So you can bring what we did in a way off of the cushion and into your life. And here's a way to do that. So after this, it's the afternoon here in Vermont, and my niece, who is 5, my daughter is also 5. She's having a birthday. She's turning 5 tomorrow. So we're having a little birthday party for her. You know, so these are little beings who are going to be very happy and joyful and excited to see each other and, you know, excited to eat ice cream. And so already there's this external, you know, feel good happening there. And so what I can do if I want to bring some intention to that space and try to kind of, you know, practice in that space is I can go to that party with them and soak in that goodness and that joy and happiness, and also, you know, reflect it back to them. And I can do that in a, you know, kind of concentrated way, kind of intentional way. And Shinzen, he calls this, he says it's like a background technique that you can do in life. And, you know, you do it when you're around people that you enjoy being with. And this is in one of the articles that I will share with you guys, but he calls it a samadhi of love. You know, so it's like this concentration of love that you're just, this concentration practice, and you're offering it to the people that you're with, and they're giving it back to you, maybe not intentionally, but, you know, you're in this field together. And so that's a way to bring this practice into your life. Shinzen, he references this Japanese idiom, which I'll show you. I like this. I'm not going to pronounce it right, but I'll try. It's jibun ni i ito ni i, which means good for you and good for others. You know, so it's that kind of a practice. It's, you know, both good for you and good for others. So that's a way to bring this into life. So I have this other idea that I want to share with you, and I think it's important. Rick Hansen, actually, in this article that I'll share with you, he mentions it a little bit, and it is that energy of, like, you know, you're trying to do good, but it's turned into this striving, and it's the attitude has gotten a little bit twisted into, like, you know, you're needing to do good, or you're needing somebody to feel better, and it's a little bit too intense. And I know that in America, for sure, that is a attitude that comes up, you know, in our work life and in relationships, and, you know, we're always trying to be good or be better and, you know, be good for other people. And so I want to encourage you to watch that, to be aware of that, and to see if you can connect with something that is a little bit more friendly towards yourself, a little bit less driven And, just to back off a little bit and have it be more of a balanced energy. And Rick Hansen talks about how that's kind of when like working with goes wrong, it's too extreme. And it's just a common thing that can happen. I don't know about you all, but I've been watching some of the Olympics. So it's just started, and I really like the road cycling. I used to do that a long time ago in another life, and so I was looking at these interviews with some of the female road cyclists who I think they actually competed last night, Eastern time. And one of the cyclists, one of the Italian cyclists, her name is Alisa Longo Borghini, and she said something, before the race that you don't have to be a superhero to get it right. It was something along those lines. You don't have to be a superhero to get it right. You just have to show up and be there and put some effort in. And I really appreciated that. That seemed very like, related to what we're talking about, that you don't have to get it perfect. You don't have to be perfect to win. And that's what she was saying, really. You could win the race while still, messing up a lot, not having to be perfect. You don't have to be a superhero. And I think that applies to this kind of practice. We're just continually trying to, bring this goodness into our lives, into our hearts, into our relationships. You don't have to have it be perfect, and you don't have to be perfect in order to do it. And that's, I don't know, I think it's a refreshing way to think about it. So I was at a retreat with Annie Nugent and Deborah Ratner Helzer, and they are teachers. They teach a lot at IMS, Insight Meditation Society, in Massachusetts here in the United States. And we were doing, pretty like traditional insight practices, and then we added in some love and kindness. And one thing that Deborah said, which, hadn't heard a lot emphasized before, was this kind of impersonal attitude when you're practicing love and kindness or compassion. So it's like you're not having an agenda to it. It's not like you're really fixated on the outcome. You're just offering this goodness, this, well-wishing, this wholesomeness out into the world or out towards a particular being, but without an agenda, without needing to fix them or have them be any different. So again, I just appreciate the attitude, and I think it's one that's important to bring to these kind of practices. So this is a favorite poem of mine, and I've been reading a lot lately of Khalil Gibran. He was a Lebanese poet and philosopher, and this poem is about having that kind of a relationship with your children. And so I'll just read it to you and see what it evokes in you. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you, for life goes not backward nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children, as living arrows, are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might, that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness. For even as he loves the arrow that flies, so he loves also the bow that is stable. So I have a lot more I want to share with you, and I'm going to try to condense it a little bit. I just want to point out also that, you know, doing these kinds of practices is good for you. So it's good for you and it's good for others. There's a monk who does this practice, has been doing this practice for tens and tens of thousands of hours. His name is Matthieu Ricard, and you can look him up. But, you know, I'm kind of interested in neuroscience and have been for a long time. And this is older science now, but they did look at his brain when he was doing this practice. And when, you know, so the prefrontal cortex is this part of your brain, you know, kind of behind your eyebrows. And when activation happens in the left, that is associated with positivity. So, you know, people who tend to be more anxious or depressed, they have more activation going more towards the right. And so Matthieu Ricard, his brain, it's off the charts. It is like, you know, compared to normal brains and even brains of people who I think tend to be happy, his is off the charts. And I think that's just to show you, or that illustrates, you know, that there are these neural correlates of happiness and that they can be trained. That, you know, when you do these practices, you are training this part of the brain and changing your brain and your body. And so these practices, you know, they're good for yourself and they're good for others. And, you know, you're not just creating this action, or rather, you're not just creating this kind of energy between you, but they can also lead to good action, you know, like if you can practice these things internally and then combine that with, you know, good ethics, like ethics of, you know, what is the right conduct, what's right to do, then you kind of can't help but do good in this life. So the Persian poet and mystic Rumi, from, like, I think he was born in the 1200s, a long time ago. He has this is a little snippet from a poem. Love has set fire to my past and freed the bird of truth. I was a happy pearl, but the storm of love shattered me. Now I am the ocean water making thousands of pearls. So I think the last thing that I want to share with you all is this last, I don't know if you like this. Some of you, I'm sure, do. Some of you, maybe not as much. But I, once in a while, really like to go back to some of the quite old teachings and writings around early Buddhism. And in particular, today, I was reflecting on this one that is this translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is a monk. He's maybe in his 70s or 80s now, but he does these beautiful translations of a lot of the classical Buddhist texts. And so he translated this treatise on conduct. And it talks about how all of us, whether you're a disciple, you know, practitioner or a teacher or someone who's, you know, very enlightened and very experienced, how we all need to engage in these practices. And so I want to share a little bit about that. So this treatise, it's on the paramis or the paramitas, which are also known as the perfections. And it's, what did I write? Yeah, the perfections is a practice of perfecting certain qualities. You know, so here today we were working with compassion, with loving kindness. And so the paramis are about conduct. So, you know, this is part of, we are doing here something that's related to a traditional practice from thousands of years ago, and saying that this loving kindness or these compassion practices, they are essential. They are an essential part of the path. And they're not just for, you know, bodhisattvas who are, you know, highly enlightened. They are for you and me and everyone else in between. And so some of the different paramis or paramitas are generosity, loving kindness, patience, wisdom. I think equanimity is one. So I'll just read you this little bit. So Bhikkhu Bodhi, he is translating this treatise by Dhammapala is the original writer. And so he says, in established Theravada tradition, the paramis are not regarded as a discipline peculiar to candidates for Buddhahood alone, but are practices which must be fulfilled by all aspirants to enlightenment and deliverance. The qualities themselves are universal requisites for deliverance, which all must fulfill to at least a minimal degree to merit the fruits of the liberating path. So let me continue. For the great compassion and the great wisdom of the great beings are adorned by giving. Their giving is adorned and accompanied by loving speech by beneficent conduct, and beneficent conduct by equality of treatment. When the bodhisattvas are practicing the requisites of enlightenment, they treat all beings without exception as equal to themselves and perfect their sense of equality by remaining the same under all circumstances, pleasant or painful. So this is something to aspire to. Thus it is said, there is no diversity among them in regard to emancipation. And so that's just saying all these practitioners, there's no difference in their ability to cultivate these qualities, these paramis or paramitas. So that means you and me. So I just want to encourage you to bring this to your life. You know, stir it up in yourself. Make it a place that you can visit on demand. You know, this muscle that you can exercise. And then bring it into your relationships. Bring it into your life. And also bring it to your relationship with yourself. You know, this kindness, this goodness. All right, so it's one last little bit is, again, just to get you excited about this. People were thinking about this thousands of years ago, and they're talking about you and me. So in here, they use this word conqueror, and they mean conqueror of greed, hatred, delusion, the conqueror of the hindrances, of the poisons, you know, somebody who has been able to work through some of the suffering. And I'm going to change the he to a she just because it's good to do that sometimes. So we're talking about those who practice these practices. She is truthful, generous, and peaceful, endowed with wisdom and sympathy, complete in all the requisites, what good can she not achieve? She is the great compassionate teacher, equanimous yet seeking the welfare of all, free from concern on all occasions. Oh, how wonderful is the conqueror! Dispassionate toward all things of the world and toward all beings of equal mind, still she abides devoted to their welfare. Oh, how wonderful is the conqueror! Always engaged in work, promoting the welfare and happiness of all beings, she never ceases on account of the trouble. Oh, how wonderful is the conqueror! Okay. So just a reminder to everyone out there that we at Sangha Live are dependent on you to help us to keep going. You know, this program that we're using in order to connect costs money. And, you know, this is our work that we do, Caroline's work and my work and all the people behind Sangha Live. So I want to encourage you to donate if you can. And, you know, remember that this is a tough time for our global community. There are people on this call who can't afford to donate. And there are people on this call who can, who maybe COVID has not affected you as strongly in your life and in your work as some other people have been. So just to consider that, you know, when you're considering what to give, know that your donation is also making it possible for other people to access these resources, to join in this community. And just thank you. Thank you for your donation, which, you know, dana is a practice. One of the paramitas is generosity. So in this way, it is a practice when you are offering aid to this program. So, and I think we'll take some questions now. So it's time for your questions. If you folks have any, there's a button on the bottom. This is ask a question. You could just click that and then type in your question, or you can tell Caroline in the chat that you want to come on video and ask your question also. So fun to see all of you and where you're from. I love all questions, but I love questions about your practice. So like if you have questions about the technique that we did, or, you know, I want to make sure that you understand what we did, because it's tough. I can't talk to each one of you. So this is a time, if you have any questions about the technique, this is a great time. And of course, if you have questions about anything, please share them with us. So Teresa asked a question shared with us that she said, I have concentration and memory issues. Meditating can be a real challenge for me. Any tips? So well, one is just first, it's great that you're sticking with it. I think that, you know, so meditation, it does exercise concentration. It asks of us concentration, but it also asks of us these other skills, one of which is equanimity. And so, you know, when you're using those different skills, you're still on the path, you know? And so I think what I'm trying to say is equanimity in particular, you know, it's this allowing of experience as it is. And so when you're having trouble, when you're having the experience, to yourself that, oh, I'm not concentrating well, this isn't going well, if you can bring equanimity to that experience, you're still going to be gaining something from the meditation, because that equanimity is allowing you to not push and pull on that experience. So, you know, here it is. If you're not concentrating well, that is what's happening. You know, there's not high concentration, but bringing equanimity to that can still allow you to gain insight into, you know, what we're looking for in gaining insight into in meditation. So, you know, it's this allowing attitude that you're allowing things to arise and pass naturally. You can still see, you know, experiences coming up and going away. Like you can see, oh, here I'm concentrated. Oh, now I'm not, you know, you're still getting this, this insight into these qualities of mindfulness. And in particular with the loving kindness stuff, just as a practical tip. So, you know, I described doing this in person and with other people. And so that may be a way to stay connected with the practice, where you don't feel like you have to, you know, have this one-pointed concentration and you're fighting it all the time. Just really kind of relax into the experience of being with other people and just continue to kind of come back and notice internally those feelings of, you know, whatever they are, maybe joy or happiness. In that way, you're exercising those muscles the same way you would sitting by yourself on a cushion. So these are ways that you can kind of, it's not a trick, but it's a tip, you know, to still access those states. They don't have to be, you know, highly, highly concentrated in order to still access them and benefit from them. So I hope that makes sense. Let me know if not, Teresa. Okay, a couple other questions here. Vabhav, he or she asks, how frequently should we do compassion practices and balance them with insight concentration practices? There's probably a lot of different opinions about this. I would say to not stress about that too much and do meditation that is fun for you. So like, you know, if you feel really drawn to doing concentration practice or a compassion practice or an insight practice, you know, go with that. Like, you know, the idea is to keep practicing, you know, having that continuity and that continuity throughout the week, throughout the month, throughout your life. And so sometimes certain things get boring and it's okay to switch to something else. But you might notice that, you know, part of what I was saying in my Dharma talk and even in the meditation was like, you're exercising the same muscles with any of these practices, concentration, sensory clarity, equanimity, they're in everything. They are exercised in slightly different ways, but it's not a problem. Like for sure, you could do a compassion practice for the rest of your life. And if that was the only thing that you ever did, you could have, you know, the same benefits of waking up and freedom that somebody who's doing insight practice could. I think that's really important to stress. Like these things are exercising the same muscles. These different practices are exercising the same muscles. It's coming from a slightly different angle, but it's okay. So it's okay to choose what you're interested in or what you feel drawn to. Okay, what else? And you guys can ask follow-up questions too if you want more. Okay, so Joshua Goldberg asked, the practice today moved from visualization, yep, to inner talk, to bodily felt sense, then stacking the three. What does moving in this way, then stacking, do? Is there something going on neurologically? Well, certainly using different parts of the brain to do those different spaces to, investigate or create things in those different spaces. Without going into it too deeply, obviously, there's visual parts of our brain, parts that are dedicated to visual stuff and parts that are dedicated to auditory and listening. And then, the felt sense in the body, like kind of proprioceptively or just, like in space, and then also the emotions in the body. These are all they are mapped onto different places in the brain. So ostensibly, when we're visiting those, we are, exercising them, activating them, separately. And then I would assume that when you stack them on top, that they're activating in concert. I don't know what else to say about that. Is there something going on neurologically? Joshua, feel free to ask a follow-up if you have if you're wanting to know something more specific than that. I hope that makes sense. Okay, so, oh, I see people have made comments about their questions in the comments. So, great, great, Teresa. I'm glad that this is helpful. Okay, so, okay, yep, we'll see. Has this question, oh, I like this question. Not, I like all of your questions, so this is an important one. So, how important is it to practice? Whoop, where did it go? How important is it to practice meditation with a sangha versus on our own? So, actually, Shinsen, my teacher, has a has some guidelines around this, and so I think it's really important to at least check in with a teacher once in a while, at least like once a year. So somebody who, has some experience and authority and, is going to hopefully steer you in the right way if you get off track. So I think it is important to check in with a teacher, around your practice at least once a year, if not more frequently. And, but you asked about Sangha. And so I would say, the teacher is part of that Sangha, but Sangha also means, this community of people to practice with. And in some ways, that's like kind of what it's all about. Like we're, I think, there's this guy I'm thinking of, Vincent Horn. He's another teacher some of you may have heard of, and he founded this group called Buddhist Geeks. And I think at one point he said Buddhism is a team sport. And I agree with that like, we can get so much more from it from being in community and being able to talk about our practice and like bounce stuff off of each other, and then also just be spiritual friends, Kalyanamitta, like to have people who are also on the path with you together, and can share or relate to the experiences that you're having. Like it's so powerful to have that. And so, I think you could, I guess, practice on your own your whole life and still get benefit from it. But the relationships that you have with people who are going through the similar experiences, they really are invaluable. And they can, I'll say, like, in my own experience, like, I've been practicing for a number of years, and like especially during the beginning, like there are times when you go through really hard times, things are hard, like stuff comes up, or I don't know, just your world can get kind of tilted in funny ways, and It's so good to have other people to lean on in those times and to talk to and to, get guidance from. So, yeah, I think it is pretty important. And man, I mean, you can feel it even just on this call, right? Like there is this energy, this collective energy from practicing together that you just don't have when you're all by yourself, sitting by yourself. There's something powerful to that. I think it's an energizing quality. It can invigorate your practice and yeah. So, let's see. Okay, so Joshua added a comment. I was curious about the movement between the three because most of my experience with meditation is to stay with one anchor, like the breath, physical sensation, etc. Yeah. So, not sure what else to say about it, but yeah, they're just using different parts of the brain for sure. And there's definitely, as I was mentioning in the Dharma talk, like so many different traditions that will have different practices. And they do use different parts of the brain, definitely. I was just talking about Matthieu Ricard and the neuroscience research. I think they did maybe fMRI in his brain. I can't remember, or maybe EEG, something to measure, like the activation, And so like that kind of like love activation is not going to happen the same way as when you're doing just like an awareness practice. And that activation is not going to be the same as when you're practicing, on focusing on the breath as an anchor. So yeah, for exercising is like exercising different muscles in the brain. I think that's a good thing. Let's see. So I think we have enough time. I can take a couple more questions if you guys have anything more. Oh, Kate Anderson. Okay. I noticed that you work with the traumatic brain injury community. I'm in long-term TBI recovery and I have a regular meditation practice, but are there any types of meditation you recommend in particular for TBIs and chronic illness? This might sound really funny, and I can say more about this, Kate, if you want to contact me, we can talk about it too. Any of you are welcome to contact me. Here, I'll just put my website here. You can find me on the interwebs there. So, Kate, though, you said, are there any types of meditation you recommend? So, this might sound like kind of a funny way to answer that, but like when you're in recovery from TBI in particular, let me just talk about TBI in particular, things are getting better. There's something that can happen where you're always, say you have a moment where, you're feeling dizzy or you have a headache or you're feeling kind of flooded or anxious, like, and those are actually kind of normal human experiences. You can have this moment where you go, oh my gosh, is that from the TBI? And that just seems to happen kind of in every person I've worked with who in recovery. It's like there's this like kind of anticipatory like, oh no, that must be from the TBI, or maybe that's from the TBI. And so I think that that can be a place to focus if you're talking about, how to use meditation to reduce suffering in particular ways that we're suffering. That's a particular way that I feel like people in recovery from TBI really suffer. And, so bringing mindfulness to that reactivity of like, oh no, is this the T is this because I had a TBI? Am I, is this a symptom again? It's like a kind of fear activation is happening in the body, it's happening in the mind, just noticing that, you know, noticing that activation, noticing that reactivity can be really helpful. And, you know, being able to bring some mindfulness to it, some concentration, clarity, equanimity can help to diffuse that kind of fear cycle a little bit. So you can, you know, disembed from that pattern, and start to allow you to, you know, have some of those normal everyday human experiences without always connecting them with that past trauma, which it was, you know, the TBI was a trauma. So that's one, just one way. I think you could add some of the love to that too, some of that kindness and gentleness. When you notice that that particular stuff is coming up, that's just one thing off the top of my head that I've done a lot with people, but you can email me if you want to talk about it more. I know that we're almost out of time here, and I want to, just say that, I am available. I have some openings starting in September for new meditation students. So if you're interested in working with me one-on-one, please get in touch. And, good, Kate. Great. I'm glad that was helpful. So I think that was it. Just a reminder for those of you who got on a little bit late. So Sangha Live is going on. Yep. Oh, Caroline is reminding you. It's going on vacation for a summer break for the next 6 weeks. And then Martin Alward will be starting back up the fall and the rest of the year on September 5th with a new program. So I hope you can join us again then. And okay. And I have this one last poem. I'm kind of on a Khalil Gibran kick. He really was trying to, I think, in his life, interrogate that balance of, like, you know, loving someone and also, like, not having a big agenda for them. He had this, you know, passionate love affair with this woman who was also his, like, sponsor in his art and in his work. And, you know, he was trying to figure out this balance of, like, how to be in a relationship with this person without all of that grasping, without that craving, without that drivenness. Anyway, so he wrote another poem about it, and I really like it. And I'll just end with that and share that with you all. Thank you all. It's such a pleasure to be with you. I really enjoy Sangha Live and all of you, being with all of you. It's a treat. All right, so here's the poem. So it's part of, if you want to go into Khalil Gibran, it's from The Prophet, which is one of his most famous books. So he's talking about relationships here. Somebody's asking him questions about his opinion on relationships. And he goes, "Love one another, but make not a bond of love. Let it rather be a moving sea between the shores of your souls. Fill each other's cup, but drink not from one cup. Give one another of your bread, but eat not from the same loaf. Sing and dance together and be joyous, but let each one of your let each one of you be alone, even as the strings of the lute are alone, though they quiver with the same music. Give your hearts, but not into each other's keeping. For only the hand of life can contain your hearts. And stand together, yet not too near together, for the pillars of the temple stand apart, and the oak tree and the cypress grow not in each other's shadow." Okay, thank you so much. Be well. I'll see you next time.